Support for Access Utah comes from Crumb Brothers Artisan Bread at 300 South and 300 West in Logan. Now open Monday through Saturday until 2, offering a changing menu of a specialty salad, French breakfast pastries with local seasonal fruits, and lunch sandwiches. Hello and welcome to Access Utah. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in the studio with me today is Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden in Logan. And it's nearing the end of the season, and we'd love to take your gardening questions or comments. Our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Or you can go online to upr.org. Or you can tweet us your question at hashtag AUGarden. And we'd love to have you follow us on Twitter. So it's AU underscore garden is how you follow us. So anyway, Mark, thanks for coming in.
You're welcome. Thank you.
And we'll turn your mic on. And okay, there you are.
There we go.
And,
that works.
So there's still a few things to do. I mean, the leaves are falling off the trees.
Oh, yeah.
And the potatoes and onions have been dug. Well, mostly.
They should have.
In most gardens, yeah.
Beautiful fall, though.
It was really nice.
Just nice. I mean, we had like 5 days of cold weather, but otherwise it has been just a gorgeous fall. Lots of fall color. The trees have been beautiful. It has been a little bit dry, though, so that's probably something we should talk about is...
That's a big issue for getting them to winter over.
It really is. You know, I think last year... Everybody felt like it was such a wet year that once the first part of October rolled around, we started to get some cold weather. Everybody just like shut their sprinklers off, and they were done for the year. And then we had a really dry October. We had a really dry November. We had a really dry December. We had a really dry January. And a lot of those plants just didn't get any moisture through the whole winter time. And then the spring.
And no snow cover.
Yeah, no snow cover and no snow to really melt and keep that soil moist through the winter time. And the spring, they all started to leaf out. And then we had a lot of trees that just started to shrivel up and die. And it's from fall and winter stress. And so it's really not a bad idea every 2 or 2.5 weeks right now to give your trees and shrubs a good soaking so that when the ground does freeze, if we don't get, you know, consistent storms coming through here in the next couple of weeks, that there's some good soil moisture for those plants.
And in southern Utah, they got doused pretty good, like from about Cedar City
on
south.
But
in northern
Utah,
they
got like an inch of rain, and even Salt Lake got quite a bit, I think, and we just didn't get a whole lot. And
what did we end up with, like?
A tenth of an inch, but that's just not enough. And so if you have shut your sprinklers off, that's okay. But just make sure and deep soak your trees and shrubs so that they have good soil moisture when the ground freezes. Probably here in about a month is when the ground will really freeze. It's generally about that third week of November when the ground finally freezes. And, you know, we need to have that soil moisture there for trees and shrubs. And it really doesn't hurt to water your lawn once every 2 or 3 weeks, too, just to keep the lawn happy through the fall. And, you know, it makes a big difference for the next year.
Well, and yesterday when I was in my basement, I just thought, you know, I need to turn off the water to go outside. Now, we've got a hydrant that stays on all winter.
Sure.
But the house water, it's gotten cold some of the nights. I'm already hoping that I haven't frozen the pipes that go outside. So I did shut that off. So now's a good time to drain your
usually by the end of this month we like to have everything drained and cleaned out and ready to go. Fortunately my sprinkler system is self-draining, so I don't have to worry about blowing it out or anything, which is really nice. It's just when I turn the water off, it just kind of drains out all on its own, so that's very convenient. That makes it really nice. But you know, bulbs especially, we were kind of talking about bulbs before the show started, and bulbs, that's another issue that people have, is you get them planted and forget to water them, and then they go all winter without water, and it dries them up, they're desiccated, and they just don't produce flowers the next year. So
right now, it's still plenty of time to put in bulbs, because basically you're just trying to get some roots established before they come out.
Oh, yeah, yeah. In fact, this is my favorite time of year to plant. Usually the 15th through the 25th of October is the best time of year to plant, because annuals have finally died. You know, usually we've got a killing frost, and pretty much a lot of our annuals, except for our petunias and geraniums, have kind of made it through. But marigolds bit the dust, and, you know, there's a lot of dead black sad-looking annuals out there. So we'll yank those all out, plant the bulbs in there. And bulbs are so easy to plant. I mean, if you do not think that you have a green thumb in any way, bulbs are definitely the way to go. I mean, you dig your hole, put a little fertilizer down the bottom, work it into the soil, drop your bulb in, cover it up, water it, you're done.
And even if you didn't put any fertilizer in it and just put them in the hole, they'd still come
still,
up. It wouldn't be as
still
big.
Come
but...
up. Yeah, yeah, the fertilizer really helps. Bone meal is a great way to do that. Nice slow-release source of phosphorus, breaks down very gradually. It can last up to 2 years, you know, feeding those bulbs, so that's a good way to go. And then you know, on my radio show on Saturday, I had Hank Stufbergen from Stufbergen Bulbs. He's a founding member of the Holland Bulb Growers Association, and he had just a ton of great information.
On the phone, or did he actually?
No, he was
town?
Actually he was actually there. Yeah,
wow.
So he was actually in studio, and we talked about a lot of different things. And he said the bulbs can handle the cold if they have developed a root system. So if you're trying to do them in pots and grow them, you know, in a pot, and then have them, you know, produce flowers for you the next year, you've got to have them insulated or protected because they haven't really developed that root system and gotten established before the cold comes in. But the bulbs that we plant out in the ground, you know, they have plenty of time to get that root system established before the cold really sets in, because they're down deeper in the soil and the soil kind of insulates and protects them, and so they can develop that root system and they can handle the cold a lot better. So I actually learned a few things from him that I didn't know before. So...
Well, what else did you learn? I mean, this is always good stuff.
Oh, it's really some really good stuff. The Holland Bulb Growers Association has put together a really, really nice website, and it's called digdropdone.com.
Okay.
And that's how easy it is to plant the bulbs. You dig your hole, drop the bulb in, and you're done. And so it's digdropdone.com. There's a lot of great information on there on layering your bulbs if you're going to do them in pots, on just planting. There's some great instructional videos there. It's a very nice web page, and they've done a really good job.
It looks good.
Yeah.
They've got Bulbs 101, a bulb browser to find your next favorite bulb, family fun, so bulb-themed activities.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, oh, there's a ton of great stuff on there. So very nice web page that they've put together, and a lot of good resource information for gardeners out there. But when it comes down to it, bulbs are just like so simple and so easy to do. It's kind of hard to mess them up.
So what's new in bulbs?
You know, nothing. No specific varieties that are like
you've never seen
before.
Any new patterns,
or anything.
Color patterns.
Lots of really nice colors. Of course, the bulb growers are always developing new varieties, because the older varieties eventually just kind of fall out of use because of verticillium and fusarium. And it gets into the bulbs, and so a lot of those strains that, you know, were familiar, say 30 or 40 years ago, can't even get those anymore because they've just kind of phased them all out. Because over time, they just gradually pick up some of these diseases, and it'll just kind of wipe a whole strain out. But they're constantly coming up with new varieties and replacing old ones with improved varieties that have, you know, more intense color, or maybe last longer. Haven't come up with a tulip that's deer-proof yet, so. Yeah.
Too bad they can't make it look like a tulip but taste like a daffodil.
Yeah, that'd be perfect. That'd be perfect. If we can keep those deer away, that would be really nice. So,
and I guess we wouldn't want them to look like box elder bugs either.
No.
Nothing will eat a box elder bug. Well, join our conversation with your question or comment at 1-800-826-1495 or through upraccess@gmail.com. Or you can also Twitter your question at #AUGarden. So let's talk in specifics then about the bulb. So you got bone meal. What are you doing? About a tablespoon of bone meal per...
Teaspoon to a tablespoon per bulb. And there's so many different ways you can plant the bulbs. I mean, you can use a bulb planter and dig individual holes for each bulb, or you can take a shovel and dig, you know, 14-inch round holes and put 7 or 10 bulbs in there and just have big clumps of color that come out. It's such a personal preference thing. You know, I've got customers that will come in the store, and we've got 75 different kinds of tulips, you know, all on one big shelf. It's just all tulips. And there's so many different ones to choose from, and you know, early blooming and late blooming, and double flowering and lily flowering. I mean, there's so many different ones to choose from. And they'll basically just have a bag in their hands and close their eyes, and just whichever box they touch first is what goes in the bag. And then when they get home, they'll just kind of broadcast them out over the flower bed and plant them wherever they land, and that's how they. And I've got other customers have little templates that, you know, want the whole, certain colors go in each spot. And
there's a certain pattern they want planted.
And it doesn't matter. They all look great. They all look nice. Yeah.
Well, and it really is personal preference, because I know for me, I tend not to like too much color in one spot. I like to have one color and then move on to another color and then another color. Or at least have dual colors, like maybe I'm doing white and apricot together.
Have big splashes of color that come up. Yeah. So, our gardening calendar that we're putting together right now, we're just going to get it printed this week. In fact, there's a photo for April in there that's tulips with a little bit of snow on them, and it's red, and I think it's red and yellow together, and it's so pretty. It is such a pretty photo, there's so many nice color combinations. You know, pink and yellows look really nice together, and reds and yellows look nice together. There's a lot of really great complementary colors. White's a great accent to put in with any real strong color as well, too.
So what is the earliest flowering bulb?
Earliest flowering bulb would have to be the snowdrops. So Galanthus it comes up basically as soon as the snow melts, and they're just popping up. Sometimes they're even coming up when there's just a little bit of snow left out there. So that's one of the earliest. And then crocus are very, very early also. And I learned on Saturday from Hank, crocus multiply really, really quickly, and they're very long-lived. He said there's places that he's seen where they've had the same crocus bulbs in there for 30 or 40 years.
Wow.
And they just kind of keep going and multiplying.
So they're more resistant to the diseases.
A little bit more resistant and very resilient to varying conditions, and they multiply really fast. So, you know, tulips, for them to get a tulip to split and to develop another bulb, sometimes takes a couple years. And he said the crocus will split in a year. They'll actually multiply in a year. Yeah, and I didn't realize that.
Is it just because they're smaller?
They're a little bit smaller, but they're just a little bit more productive, I guess, and they split and multiply a lot faster. So,
well, I just love those early flowers that come up.
Yeah.
We have some snowdrops, and they're actually green and white.
Yeah.
And I have them on the south side of the house, right up next to the steps.
Sure.
So they tend to come out even earlier.
Probably even like February sometimes.
They're out in February.
Yeah. So that's fun. So crocus definitely would be next up after that. A lot of your miniature daffodils are very early bloomers also.
There's one called Tête à Tête that we have that they're just so pretty.
They're really cute. Yeah, and they're only like 6 to 8 inches tall and real small flowers, but they come out really quickly also. And then, of course, your Grigi tulips, so some of those really early tulips. I like the Grigis because they've got very colorful foliage. So the foliage is either variegated or speckled or striped, and in many cases the foliage is attractive as well as the flowers. And so those are great too. Then your early spring tulips. Then usually you have your mid-season daffodils, and then your late tulips are blooming after that.
What about the species tulips, the ones that are more from where modern tulips got developed from? They're a little bit more delicate. They seem to take shade a little bit more.
Yeah, there's the you've got your Grigi, and then you've got
that's a species tulip.
Yeah, then you've got your Fosteriana, which are your emperor tulips. Both of those are very, very early, and there's other varieties too. I can't name them all. So,
how long have tulips been around?
Oh, that's a good question. I couldn't even. I think 1400s, or probably even earlier. Don't even hold me to that. So I'll have to go back and do a little research.
Dutch Netherlands, is that the area where they were developed?
I don't think that's where they were developed. They just found that to be a perfect place to grow them, and so I think they actually came from Persia area. You're going to look it up now, aren't you?
I am going to look it up.
Now you're like curious, so. I'm thinking it came from the
Central Asia.
Yeah, from
cultivated by the Turks as early as 1000 AD.
Yeah, so there we go. And then they were probably picked up by the Crusaders and brought back into Europe, and then they found that Holland was a perfect place for them to grow. And so they've grown them ever since.
So what makes Holland the perfect place?
Soil and moisture, drainage, and with the dikes, the way they've
drainage.
Built them. Well, they have really sandy soil.
Okay.
Yeah, they have really sandy soil, and so they grow like crazy. I mean, they've had to create the location for them to grow, but the climate and
so they don't have much clay there.
No,
apparently.
Mm-mm.
So
yeah. So climate and soil conditions are perfect for growing them there. So we're going to have to go in April. It's like Hank was like inviting us to come, and I was just like, man, April is just not the best time for a garden center owner to just, you know, up and leave
well,
for 2 weeks.
When would any time be good for a garden center when you actually see something growing?
Yeah, we can do it, but usually April and May are kind of, you know, an athba. We just don't even discuss leaving the store at that time. So
because everybody needs Mark. Everybody... It's just there's so many questions that get asked.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I'm sure you've probably found, well, but I need to talk to Mark, even though others could answer the question.
There's always somebody else that can usually answer, but they still want to talk to me, so that's all right. So I did a pretty good job remembering that with the tulips then. So
yeah,
I would suspect it's probably 1400s that they were introduced into Europe. But if you're saying, you know, about the thousands, 1100s, That would make sense, yeah.
Okay, so as far as the tulips, what's the latest you could actually put them in, do you think?
You know, we've actually planted tulips in January before when we've had that January thaw.
And you know,
we had enough cold? Had some tulips left over, and you know, the weather broke, and we had some nice weather where we could get outside and actually dig the soil and plant them. And we've put them in December and January before with no problem. They really need 14 weeks of cold weather. If you're forcing them for inside, you know, say you're doing them in pots, you're going to grow them inside, you're going to force them and have them blooming inside for Valentine's Day. They need 12 to 14 weeks of cold temperature. Usually about 45 to 50 degrees is perfect. So if you have an old refrigerator that you're not really using, and you can adjust the temperature so it's about 45, 48 degrees, that would be like perfect location to do those bulbs in. And Hank told me that this is pretty funny too. He said they actually pre-cool and prepare bulbs, 80,000 of them, for Ross Perot.
Oh, good grief.
To have for his wife's birthday.
80,000?
80,000 bulbs they prepare for him to give to his wife for her birthday because they live in like Houston, Texas area, and they can't do bulbs there. And so they prepare them and they grow them in their big coolers and have them ready to go, and they deliver them just like right before they're ready to bloom so their gardeners can go out and plant them in their garden and have tulips blooming all over.
So they just have a cooler, or they just stick a ball in there?
Yeah. And you can actually force them in a refrigerator like that without even putting them in soil.
And how many weeks of that cool? And you can't put them next to apples or anything like that, or bananas.
12 weeks. So you got to do them for 12 weeks in cold. And you can just like keep them in a bag in the refrigerator for 12 weeks. But then after you plant them up, they have to have a little bit more time to develop the root system and to flower. I mean, so you can take them and you can just pre-chill them so that they'll bloom. And he actually works hand in hand with Cornell University. And they've been doing a lot of research on bulbs. And it wasn't until just recently that they realized that you can actually just do that in the refrigerator. And then plant them up and let them bloom. They've always felt like they had to develop a root system
first
in the soil during that cold storage period before you could, you know, get them to bloom. But they've actually been doing enough research with them that they found that you can put them in there for 10, 12 weeks and then pot them up in soil afterwards. And if they still get a little bit of cold weather, they'll develop that root system and develop that flower bud, and all of a sudden they're blooming.
So could you do the same thing with hyacinths then?
Yeah. And the hyacinths...
Because usually I've potted mine up first, thinking that's the way
the hyacinths actually force better than the tulips. And some of the hyacinth bulbs that we bring in, they've been pre-chilled so that it's taken about 4 to 6 weeks off the forcing process. And so they've already been prepared.
Because normally if you got the bulb yourself or you dug up some of yours and you wanted to bring him in the house, you'd have to do it for how long in the fridge?
Yeah, for 12 weeks.
So full 12 weeks.
You have to do 12 weeks. So having those prepared bulbs cuts your bloom time your preparation time for bloom, it cuts it down considerably. But they've been able to do that just in a refrigerator and keep those bulbs at 48 degrees. He said 48 is kind of like the magic number. If you can keep them at 48 degrees, that's what they really, really like.
So you'd have to have almost another refrigerator or something, because your main refrigerator is usually, what, 36,
it's usually colder.
38?
Yeah, it's
like
usually
that.
Colder. So that's what I was saying. In another refrigerator, it would be perfect because you wouldn't have to keep it quite so cold. And you could control the environment a little bit. And he said, if you're doing, like, say you're doing an 8-inch pot, you want to, you know, force some bulbs in there, you can just put them right in the soil, water them thoroughly so there's good soil moisture there, stick them in your cold storage location, whether it's in a fridge or in the crawl space underneath the house, or, I mean, if you've got a good spot to keep those in to force them with. The key is you got to make sure they don't freeze, so they've got to stay above freezing. But if you can keep them in that 45-degree range, you know, 45, 48 degrees, that's really perfect for them.
So I've got a warmer storage for my squash. That's not where I'm going to want to put these. I'm going to want to put this in the one that gets cooler, that doesn't usually drop below 40.
Yeah.
So, okay. Well, Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden is in studio. We would like to take your questions or comments. It's 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. Go online to upr.org, and you can email us through our website, or just do it directly at upraccess@gmail.com, or tweet us your question at #AUGarden. And you can also follow us on Twitter. I send out a couple of timely tips each week, and you can follow us on Twitter at AU_garden. So, Mark, let's look at some other bulbs. You pretty well treat them all the same as far as when you're planting and what time to plant and how deep to plant.
So planting time is like prime time right now for pretty much all your fall planted, spring flowering bulbs. But then depending on the bulb, you've got some different depths you've got to work with. So, you know, crocus, of course, probably about 2 inches deep is plenty, where tulips and daffodils were going closer to 4 to 6 inches deep. And then if you're doing something like alliums or crown imperials, you know, the fritillaria, then you'd go even a little bit deeper because the bulbs are much, much, much larger. And they've got to go a little farther down to support them.
What about putting in something like lilies? If you've got them or do you want to transplant them, is it too late for that?
You can do lilies, because the lilies are hardy enough, they can make it through the winter without any problem. Normally we bring our lilies in the springtime, you know, like our Asiatic and our Oriental lilies, like Casablanca, I mean, some of those stargazers, one that's really familiar. Those usually come in like March and April, and we'll pot those up and they'll bloom that first year. But they can definitely be planted in the fall. They'll winter over and divide and multiply like crazy, so they do very well in our climate.
But there's another example of ones that if they haven't had any water for a while, you need to give them some water.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, at the top of the show, that's what
they'll just desiccate, the bulb will shrivel up, then you won't have much next year if they do survive.
That's what we were talking about. I don't remember how many years it was. Probably about 8 years ago or so. I was planting about 500 daffodils in front of our house, and it was a little bit later. It was probably the first or second week of November, and we'd had a little bit of snow, and then the snow melted off, but the ground was kind of frozen. And then we had a couple of nice warm days, and I went out there, and the surface was just kind of frozen just a little bit, but then it was soft underneath, and so I kind of broke through the surface, and I planted all those daffodils. And by the time I got done, the sun was kind of starting to go down because it was late afternoon when I got it all planted, and so I got those all planted, and I was like, oh, you know, I really need to water those, but it's getting kind of dark. It's getting kind of chilly. I think I'll do it tomorrow. It'll be okay. And so I went inside and then got another big snowstorm that came, you know, the next day. It was over. I mean, it was done. I couldn't get out there and water. And the next year, I only had probably 15 out of those 500 that bloomed.
Wow.
Yeah, because the soil was really pretty dry. Even though we had that snow cover that came, the soil was dry. They didn't get the moisture that they need, and they kind of desiccated, and they just didn't bloom well the next year. So it's essential that you get those planted and give them some moisture to work on through the wintertime.
So did you pull them all back up, or did you just leave them?
Hardly anything left. I mean, they had all just desiccated and dried up.
Dried out.
Yeah, there was just nothing left to them. So the bulb has a lot of moisture in it, and so basically what happened is the soil was much drier than the bulb. It pulled the moisture out of the bulb, reverse osmosis, and it went into the soil and it dried the bulbs out.
I guess you won't be doing that again. That's a lot
No,
of work.
That was the last time. That was the last time we did that. So, love planting the bulbs, but we make sure and water them afterwards. It's essential that you get
follow that little voice in your head that says, I probably should do this. But if the other voice says, "Nah, you can wait till tomorrow," ignore that voice.
Ignore that voice. Yeah, that's right. Because sometimes it just doesn't happen that way. So,
well, we've reached the halfway point of our program, and we're going to go until 10 o'clock. Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden is in studio, and you can join us with your questions or comments at 1-800-826-1495 or go online and at upr.org. The address is upraccess@gmail.com, or tweet us your question at #AU Garden, or follow us on Twitter at @AU_garden. So stay tuned. We'll be back in just a few minutes after the next edition of Wild About Utah.
Support for Utah Public Radio is provided by Square One Printing in Logan, with personalized printing for home or business, including business cards, letterhead, envelopes, brochures, flyers, and calendars. Information is at squareoneprinting.com.
Welcome to Wild About Utah, a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio.
Hi, I'm Holly Strand. The canyons and valleys of Utah will soon be awash with brilliant fall hues. Cascades of red, orange, and gold will blanket the hillsides as the weather turns cooler and morning frost dusts the mountain ridges. The canyon maple is one of Utah's main sources of autumn color. Like most maple species, its leaves are carved into deep lobes. The leaves are medium to bright green now, but soon the entire tree will glow with spectacular color. Canyon maple is found throughout Utah at medium elevations between 4,500 to 7,500 feet. It tends to grow on lower slopes and canyon bottoms in the mountains in association with Douglas fir and junipers. Its scientific name, Acer grandidentatum, means big tooth, referring to the tree's distinctive lobed leaves with large toothed margins. In fact, big tooth maple is another common name for this species. Some think that the canyon maple is related to the sugar maple of the northeastern and midwestern United States, says forestry professor Mike Coons of Utah State University's Department of Wildland Resources. It's likely that long ago, the Rocky Mountains rose up and isolated a sugar maple population that eventually evolved into a unique species. The canyon maple rivals its eastern relatives in fall color, but does it produce sap suitable for tasty syrup-covered waffles and pancakes? Back in the 1970s, a group of scientists set out to determine just that. The trees were tapped and yielded plenty of sticky liquid. The color resembled light honey, and the flavor was delicate and fruity, almost like pineapple. However, it was notably less sweet than the northeastern sugar maple. Of 30 panelists from Utah who participated in a taste test, 57% preferred eastern sugar maple syrup, but the remaining 43% preferred canyon maple syrup. The researchers concluded that while canyon maple sap was not practical for large-scale syrup production, it might be enjoyable for individuals to try on a small scale on private land within its habitat range. Syrup aside, the medium-sized tree thrives in Utah's residential landscapes, parks, and urban areas, as well as in the wild. Its year-round beauty, hardiness, and manageable size make it a perennial favorite in the Beehive State. Dr. Michael Coons and Marianne Mofoletto provided text and background information for this piece. Thanks to the USU College of Natural Resources for supporting research and development of this Wild About Utah topic. For Wild About Utah, I'm Holly Strand.
Wild About Utah is a partnership of the Stokes Nature Center, the Bridgerland Audubon Society, and Utah Public Radio. For transcripts and archived audio of Wild About Utah, go online to upr.org and click on the Wild About Utah link. Support for Wild About Utah on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our listeners and the Quinney College of Natural Resources at Utah State University, where students and faculty promote the sustainability of ecosystems and the communities that depend on them. Information at cnr.usu.edu.
Support for Utah Public Radio is provided by Weber State Cultural Affairs, presenting Jake Shimabukuro as part of his grand ukulele tour this Saturday at Peary's Egyptian Theater in Ogden. Details are at wsuculturalaffairs.org.
Welcome back to the second half of Access Utah. I'm your host, Brian Earle. In studio with me today until the top of the hour is Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden. We're taking your questions or comments at 1-800-826-1495. We are also taking them at, if you send an email, upraccess@gmail.com, or you can tweet us your question at hashtag AU Garden, or also follow us on Twitter, where I send out a couple of timely tips each week at AU underscore Garden. All right, Mark, we've got a couple of things left to still talk about, but first we did have someone who called in and said and asked, what are good plants to plant around bulbs for summer flowers after bulbs die? And you mentioned that this website, digdropdone.com, has some information. So I did. I went to the website. I clicked on the main site, Ready to Plant, and it has companion planting, and then you could look at planting with perennials.
Right.
So it has some suggestions on what you can do. One of these was stone crop. It says tulips single late. So it looks like single tulips that are late bloomers. Plant with sedum. And then they even mention a particular variety of sedum to put them in.
And I think Cornell University has been doing a lot more research on companion perennials that will go well with certain kind of bulbs. And that information is still a little forthcoming. So I think it's available, but they haven't got it up on their webpage yet. So that should work out really well. The single late tulips are your latest bloomers. And so they're usually coming on between, say, Mother's Day and Memorial Day. Is usually when they're
what's the difference
full
between
bloom.
A single late tulip and a regular tulip?
Well, there's like single earlies, which come on generally about the middle part of April, and then you've got Darwin hybrids and triumphs that are coming on a little bit later, maybe towards the end of April, and then your single lates are coming on, like I said, around Mother's Day, and they'll bloom until about Memorial Day.
So they're just the tall ones that have
they're the
one
tall
big
ones
flower.
With the really big flowers on them. So the single lates are really pretty. They have the great big, great big flowers on them.
Now, something else they suggested with the tulips, anyway, is they suggested Barcelona, which is a dark pink, and then plant it with Dicentra spectabilis, which is a bleeding heart.
Right, right. And they're kind of pink and white flowers, too.
Yeah, and so it's an earlier, it's bleeding heart is still kind of earlier in the spring, but the flowers would come on after.
Right after your tulips are done. So there's a lot of perennials that you can plant that will be coming on, after the tulips are all done, and they would be very compatible to grow in the same area with them. And then we've always done, tons of annuals in around our bulbs. After the bulbs are all done, the leaves are kind of starting to die down. We'll trim those down and then just, plant all kinds of different annuals in there with them. And then they'll bloom all summer and look great. And in the fall, you can pull those out, add some more bulbs, in or rejuvenate your beds. Or, there's a lot of different things you can do. So all your annuals work really, really well to go with the tulips, because generally the tulips are finishing up around the middle part of April, middle part of May. And then the annuals go in, and then you've got color all summer long.
My best bed was where I've got some iris. And then for the annual, for the summer, I planted the zinnias, the small, now I'm forgetting, profusion series.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
I had apricot and white that I alternated all along this bed, and it just...
Very nice.
Yeah, it was really, really
so
pretty.
That's after your bulbs bloomed,
so
too.
After the bulbs bloomed, and...
And the iris kind of did
the iris
thing.
Came on, and I was able to plant these. They were small in the front, and then they just got, maybe a foot and a half.
Because usually by, 1st of June, the iris are pretty much done,
Last year, it was like the third. I had some blooming in July.
Yeah.
It was so late.
Yeah,
last year.
Yeah.
This year, they were all done.
Done by the 1st of June.
By the 1st of June.
Yeah.
So.
We were lucky to have iris for Memorial Day this year. And last year, we couldn't get one for Memorial Day. So.
But then I also like to do, like this year, I have daffodils that are between the iris. So the tulips are up, and then the irises came on, and then I really like dahlias.
Yeah.
And so the dahlias at the back, that's a little more work because dahlias aren't perennials, mm-hmm. but
very
look
pretty.
Nice.
So there's tons of options of different things you can plant to complement your bulbs. The great thing about bulbs is you plant them in the fall, and they just come up and do their thing in the spring without you really having to do anything. I mean, that's truly the best part about bulbs is you do the work in the fall, and it's really not much work digging holes, dropping bulbs in there, and then they just kind of do the rest. You know,
I love that.
And you get that great spring color. And if you plan things out right, where you've got some stuff coming up early and some stuff coming up mid-season and some stuff coming up late, you can have bulbs blooming for 2 months.
And they're recommending on this website poppies would be another good one to do.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, poppies would be really good. Yeah.
Well, we have our first caller. We have Keith from St. George. Hi, Keith. How can we help?
I have two questions.
Sure.
I want to plant some seedless mulberry trees here in St. George.
Yeah.
Would it be better to plant them now, buy them in pots, or wait till spring and buy the bare roots?
You could go either way, actually. Fall's an excellent, excellent time for planting. In fact, I planted six trees last fall, just as about this time. I mean, it was like perfect for us, and they did wonderfully this year until the deer killed one this spring. But fall's a very, very nice time for planting, and especially down in St. George where things are going to start cooling off. You're probably hitting low 80s now, aren't you?
Yeah, this week will be 80s and high 70s.
Yeah, yeah.
Terrible place to live.
You could even wait another month or so and plant and still be great. I mean, December, you wouldn't have any problem. And the fruitless mulberries are great trees, very nice. The big difference you're going to find between a containerized one this fall or a bare root one next spring is, of course, cost. The containerized plant's going to be a little bit more expensive than the bare root. But it is going to be a little bit more established as well, too. So sometimes with the bare root, you've had to pull that tree out of the ground. You've had a little damage to the root system. Sometimes it takes a little bit longer for it to get established and get going. But if you're doing it during the dormant season, you know, for us here in Cache Valley, great time for planting bare roots the latter part of March, first part of April. And you'd probably be a month or 6 weeks ahead of us, weather-wise, on when you could plant your bare root. And your price is going to be your big difference. And a tree in a container is going to be 6 months to maybe even 8 or 10 months ahead of a bare root tree with the root system that's been able to establish throughout the summer.
All right. On tulips, when you're talking about them being chilled right now down here, they're selling them at the big box stores.
Yeah.
And all our displays are out sitting in the sunshine.
Yeah.
And, it's still hot every day. So
It is. And the bulbs just kind of come in all at the same time because it's bulb season, and they bring in, you know, just thousands of containers that are coming in from Holland, and the big boxes just kind of ship them out to everybody all at the same time because that's when they come in. And, for St. George, you really have to have, you know, cold temperatures for at least 12 to 14 weeks to really get those to do well. So, yeah, we're planting ours up here right now. This is like perfect time. And really for you to get them out there without them starting to grow, because the weather's nice, they could really start to grow and come up in the fall. I probably wouldn't plant mine down there for another month and then hope that you get enough cold weather to get them to do well. Have you had great luck with fall-planted bulbs?
I have thousands of daffodils.
Okay, that's good.
And I've even put wire in the ground to protect the beds.
Yeah.
And I love tulips, but the gophers will come out of their holes and crawl across the top of the ground and eat them like crazy.
Of the beds. Yeah.
I never touched a daffodil.
Yeah.
If I put tulips, I got 3 years, they're gone.
Yeah.
Daffodils last forever, so I just quit planting tulips.
Yeah. Have you ever used the sonic mole and gopher chasers that you put down the ground?
No. I have such terrible soil that I want my gophers and my moles because they're going down and getting through the caliche and I'm getting a much better drainage and everything. So unless they get my lawn, I leave them alone.
You leave them alone. All right. Yeah.
I have a pasture. And
those work pretty well.
I never kill my gophers.
Yeah, but the gophers are definitely going to eat your tulips because they're fairly tasty. So.
Oh yeah, Then I got more daffodils than I know what to do with, but not hardly a tulip.
Yeah,
left.
Fairly tasty. With your concern with those bulbs sitting out there in the heat, dry warm temperatures are not a problem as long as the bulbs are staying dormant. When I dig mine up in May, we'll put them in a bushel basket or cardboard box and stick them down the basement and just let them sit until it's time to plant them. And so, you know, the heat might be a little bit of concern, but as long as they're dry and the bulbs are firm and you can feel that life and strength inside the bulbs, they'll be just fine. It's when they really start to dry out that I would be a little bit concerned about those. So
excellent. Thank you. It was a great time to give me this lesson.
Oh, very
great.
Good.
I had no idea on the bulbs that it was at 12 to 14 weeks.
Yeah, that's what they need to develop that root system and to develop a flower bud so that they'll bloom and look great for the next year. So,
thank you.
Thank you, Keith.
Thanks, Keith.
Bye-bye.
We only have about 12 minutes left in the program, so if you'd like to get in your question or comment, our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495, 800-826-1495. upraccess@gmail.com is our email address, or you can tweet us a question at hashtag AUGarden. I think about that for a minute.
Try to remember.
All right, so I want to make sure we get this in before we forget.
Yeah.
Don't prune your roses yet.
Right.
Wait until the end of November, because if you prune them now, it's just going to cause them to want to grow some more.
Yep.
So, but you can help winterize them.
Yes.
With this super secret formula.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so, we'll tell you that formula. Don't tell anybody
else. Yeah. It's not too much of a secret, but roses definitely. You know, if we have a hard winter, cold weather, you can lose a lot of roses. And so we found a great way to make them hardier through the winter time, make them winter over a little bit better. So usually towards the end of October, first part of November, when there's a lot of leaves, you know, a lot of leaves plentiful to mulch them with. There's a lot of different things we can mulch and protect them with. But usually when the leaves are all falling off the trees, we will take a quarter of a cup of magnesium sulfate and a quarter of a cup of potash. Sprinkle that on the ground around the roses, so a quarter cup of each. Water them thoroughly, you know, just like we were talking at the first part of the show. You know, water your shrubs and trees.
You don't have to get these into the roots.
No,
this will go down into the
soil. The mag sulfate's very water soluble, so it'll dissolve and just go right into the soil. The potash is not nearly as water soluble, so you'll see the granules sitting there on the surface. But when you mulch it, they'll break down over the winter time, especially with that moisture there, and it'll gradually, you know, feed the roses through the wintertime. But it makes them hardier, about 10 degrees hardier through the wintertime. You know, the sulfur helps lower the pH, frees up the nutrient, makes it available to the roses. The potash helps the plants pick up water and pick up nutrient and just makes them healthier and makes them hardier through the wintertime. And the magnesium makes them bloom like crazy. And so by doing the mag sulfate in the fall, it will make them bloom like crazy and bloom a lot more than they normally would the next year. It's kind of a bloom encourager. And so we put the quarter cup of each, the magnesium sulfate and the potash on each rose, water it thoroughly, and then mulch your roses, whether that's with leaves or with peat moss. Or I like the soil-building compost. It's a finely ground redwood bark that's been composted with poultry manure and bat guano and worm castings and kelp meal.
Doesn't compress down as much.
And then in the spring, when I want to pull that off my roses, I don't have to take it and get rid of it somewhere else. You know, if you use the leaves and grass clippings, you have to pull that stuff all out and then take it somewhere else and compost it or till it into the garden or whatever. With the soil building compost, you can actually just pull it away from the roses and then use it as a mulch in around your roses. And, you know, an inch or two of mulch around the roses is actually really beneficial for the roses. And so we'll put 12 inches, sometimes even 14 inches up in around the graft of our roses to protect those. And then in the spring, you just pull that all back, kind of work it into the soil, and away you go. And it works very, very well.
And I suppose that if you want to alleviate some of the the issues with dying back if you happen to be in a colder area. I mean, you should still mulch, but some roses do come on their own rootstock. They're not grafted on.
Yeah,
so.
Jackson Perkins really was working on that extensively and had a lot of varieties that were doing very well on their own rootstock. And then Jackson Perkins has kind of fallen apart the last 3 or 4 years.
So they're not, are they even
so, they are still selling stuff online, but they aren't growing any of their own roses right now.
Wow.
So yeah, Jackson Perkins just fell on hard times, and
That was like the big name.
That was like the big name in roses. Yeah. So there's other growers are growing their roses for them.
So they're just in their company.
They're just
name
they're
only.
Just re- they're just retail strictly now. Yeah. So
all right. Well, let's move along then to. Pruning should take place the end of November.
Yeah, late as possible. So really we want our roses to finish flowering, to fade and develop rose hips.
Yeah, let them go to hips.
When they form the hips, it makes the roses hardier through the wintertime, makes them go dormant quicker. And so you're better off leaving those hips on the roses. And then if you do need to do a little pruning in the fall, say they're really tall, like my mom's got a Tropicana, and it just like grows 5 feet tall. It grows really tall. And sometimes we get a lot of snow. If there's snow that falls off of a tree and hits our roses, it can kind of break those. And so they'll do a little bit of maintenance pruning as late as possible, later part of November, first part of December, to kind of trim those back just a little bit. But after they're almost completely dormant is when we'll do that pruning. But I prefer to not do much pruning until spring.
Just early spring?
Usually the first weekend in April is when I'll do my roses.
Okay.
But if you prune them too early, they'll start to grow and then they'll get frozen and then get damaged. And so we try not to do too much pruning on the roses until about that last week of March, first week of April, and then go in there and clean out all the dead stuff and trim them way down. And that's really the best time to do it.
Well, and that would, I guess, hold true for most any plant. If you prune it, it stimulates it to grow
stimulates
a little
bit. Stimulates a little
bit
of growth, But you've got certain plants that really like to be pruned in the fall. Birches and maples bleed like crazy in the springtime if you prune them in the spring. So really, you're better off pruning those in the fall.
Grapes?
Grapes, usually we'll leave the grapes until spring.
Okay, so even though they're weeping a lot when you prune them, that's okay with the grapes.
But any flowering shrub that blooms before, say, Mother's Day or Memorial Day, you really don't want to prune that until after they're done blooming in late May or early June. So I had somebody call the other day, and they wanted to prune their forsythia. And it's like, well, you can, but you don't have any flowers next year. Yeah, so forsythia and lilacs for sure. If you're doing a lot of pruning right now in the fall, you're cutting all your flowers off. So you got to be real careful with those early
blooms.
They should
be pruned
right after they're done blooming. Yeah, okay. Right after they're done blooming.
All right, we actually have maybe about 60 seconds left. So let's talk real quick. Power raking and aeration should be done now as well.
Yeah. Best time of the year is in the fall. So very, very beneficial for your lawn to aerate. Anytime in October through the first part of November, as long as the ground's not frozen, does less damage to the lawn, opens the soil up so that water and nutrient can penetrate down in, allows that soil to expand out so it's not so compacted. And that's really when you should aerate, is when you walk out there on your soil, it feels like concrete, it just feels hard and compacted down. And if your water's just not penetrating down in, it's running off or puddling up on your lawn, then your drainage isn't very good and the aeration would be very, very beneficial for you. Power raking, also very beneficial in the fall. Usually you want to cut a sample out of your lawn, 10 by 10 inch square, lift it up, look at it. You can see where the soil ends and where the thatch is in that kind of transition zone from the soil. And if you have, a quarter of an inch of thatch or less, there's kind of a buildup of stems, dead stems, and it's not even really dead grass clippings. It's more dead root system and more dead stem of the grass. If you've got a quarter inch or less, that's very beneficial. Actually, it's good for your lawn to have that because it helps hold the moisture in there. But if it's more than that, if you've got a half inch or three quarters of an inch, that's when you should probably power rake and get that out so it allows the water and nutrient to penetrate down into the soil better.
Okay, Mark, thank you for coming
in. You're welcome. Thank you.
You've been listening to Access Utah. Mark Anderson from Anderson Seed and Garden has been my guest. Stay tuned, and we'll have more information coming up. Again, you can follow us on Twitter at AU_garden. Thank you for joining us on Access Utah.
What can you grow in a dark, damp location? Mushrooms, of course. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. October 15th is National Mushroom Day, and a good time to consider starting your own indoor mushroom farm. Locate your planting in a closet, cabinet, or other dark spot in the bathroom, kitchen, or basement. Most mushroom kits consist of a cardboard box or perforated plastic bag filled with a growing mix that already contains the mushroom spores. Keep the growing mix moist but not soggy wet, and the humidity high around the planting for best results. A humid location, plastic tent, and nearby pans of water can help elevate the humidity. In as little as 10 days, you should start seeing signs of life. Follow label directions for the specific light and harvesting requirements, and get the best flavor by using your mushrooms as you harvest. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
Thank you for listening to Utah Public Radio. This is KUSR HD1 89.5 Logan, KUSK HD1 88.5 Vernal, KUSL HD1 89.3 Richfield, KUST HD1 88.7 Moab, KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan. This is Utah Public Radio, Utah's favorite public radio station.